you know, I'm just going to just let the Lord lead and just be in prayer and just, you know, he's going to do what he's going to do.
Amen to that. I love it.
Okay. We're going to roll. Maggie's going to kick us off. 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Arise podcast with Danielle Castillejo and Maggie Hempill. Conversations around faith, race, justice, gender, and the church.
And I'm Danielle Castillejo. Thanks for introducing us, Maggie. And today we have special guest Dan Taylor, Coach Dan Taylor. And thank you for being with us, Dan.
It was my pleasure. This is such a huge honor.
Well, honor's ours. You know, I knew Dan from probably I met him when I was 18 years old. Think about that. And we met at Seattle Pacific University and went through school there together. And since then, I've been following along. You know, social media is great for some things. And so I've been following along a little bit with what Dan has been up to. Dan is a basketball coach. He's been doing that since 1998. He trains other coaches. He leads in equity and diversity training. He's been a PE teacher in the Edmonds School District. He's now working at King's School, and he is teaching and coaching the high school girls basketball team. And I know, Dan, you lead the girls basketball coaches for the state of Washington, correct?
Yes. My role amongst the high school girls basketball coaches is I am the state president of the Coaches Association, and I've been doing that. It'll be about 8 years this spring.
Wow,
that's amazing. I also read that you have like got Coach of the Year like 9 years or something.
That's
what it says on your bio. It said that you had gotten in 2004, 2015, and 16 Coaches of the Year, that over your the whole of your career that you have received nine of those such awards. You're just being so modest.
No, somebody must be lying out there. But we all know that when coaches win Coach of the Year, it's mainly because they have elite athletes that care about each other and that love each other and an amazing coaching staff. Like, you don't win those on your own, you know, accord. So I take those with a grain of salt because I just have amazing people that are around me. So yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, it's so good. I know you and I reconnected recently over social media, and I said, hey, Dan, would you be willing to check out my blog? I'm starting to write more about race and gender and justice in the church, kind of looking for your feedback because I admired the work you were doing. And then recently we had this chance where you invited me to come to your basketball team and give a devotional. So that was a lot of fun. And I know that we share that passion in our lives and in our homes. And so Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. is important to both of us, and it's important to Maggie. And, you know, I kind of wanted to hear a little bit how that impacts you over this weekend and over the course of your work.
Yeah. Just to kind of get people up to speed of who I am a biracial male, and my father is African American and my mother is Korean, and they met through the military. She was working for the military and he served in the army, and I moved around tons of places, and that started my journey not only through faith but also through my experiences with race and culture and ethnicity. My early childhood years, I was in the L.A. area, early 80s, where, you know, race and racial tension was going on, riots, you know, so many different things were going on in that area, especially amongst the African-American and Korean community. There was a lot of tension there. And the fact that my parents were able to have a relationship and to be able to still be together even to this day is just an amazing testimony. For them, but that has been my background, and I've been a military brat, and because of that, I've been able to make a difference. Just it's the experiences of, you know, where I've had to understand who I was and deal with identity and face racial tension from all types of directions. And so that's just a little bit about my background.
That's awesome. You know, thank you for sharing, you know, that part. And how have you seen that played out in the way that you engage your students and your players and the way that you teach students?
So being an educator of color or a coach of color, it allowed me to establish rapport with many students that maybe some teachers haven't been able to, because as we know, there's not a great percentage of staff of color in school buildings. And so when students see me, they're like, wow, somebody that is different, you know. And for many of them that are African-American or of Asian descent, they're like, wow, they have to fight, you know. And so that allows me to connect with them. It's so funny because Korean students don't readily see that I'm Korean. And when I start to speak a little bit of Korean, they're like taking it back. They're like, whoa, what just happened? You know, and stuff. I know that my mom is Korean, so I know a little bit of Korean and stuff. But it's allowed me to bring my narratives and my stories into the classroom and be able to expose kids who not had similar experiences as I have, get exposed to some of the hardship and adversity that people of color have had, but also to just bring them to my stories and my narrative to just get a feel for, you know, what it means to be a person of color. Many of my students, if you ask them, I'm the first, you know, African American male or even Asian male that they've ever had as a student. I know for me, my first educator, my kindergarten teacher, and my last educator at SPU, my master's program, Narata Mavududu, who's actually, I believe she's the dean of the education department now. Those were my bookend educators in my academic journey. And so being able to talk to students about how, you know, my experience may not be like yours, but at the same time, how can we have our shared experience and learn and grow and educate one another through it?
Oh, Dan, that is so much. You know, when you talk about being the bookends, it's striking to me that you had a kindergarten teacher and then you said your master's program, correct?
Yeah.
There's
yeah.
a lot of space in between there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know, and it's interesting because people do ask me, like, why did you become a teacher? Like, who inspires you? Like, you didn't have a lot of people of color. Because all the people of color that I had that were leaders were mainly either somebody from a church setting or a sports setting, you know, and I looked up to them and everything like that, but it was, believe it or not, it was white educators that were inspiring and went past the differences and just took me under their wing and said, hey, I love you for who you are, and I believe you have great potential, and I'm going to pour into you, and inspired me enough to where I wanted to become a teacher myself. You know, I think about my sister's varsity basketball coach who put me under his wing and taught me the game, and he was my PE teacher, and maybe that was the person that inspired me to be who I am today as far as an educator. And then my ninth grade English teacher who, you know, I remember just having a crush on her and everything, but I also wanted to just learn so much about English and literature, and at the time I wasn't a reader, and she kind of, you know, for that interest. And to this day, I just love reading. And my students are like, have you read all these books? I'm like, yeah, I just love reading. And so, but that, you know, that's been my journey. And I think that a lot of times white educators may not feel that they can't inspire kids of color, but I've seen so many do so. And I think if they pursue the opportunity to grow and go to workshops and clinics and read books on how to minister and inspire kids of all backgrounds, then they are going to be people remembered and they create the next generation of educators.
Ah, that's remarkable. And yeah, what an incredible opportunity that awaits white educators out there. What are some of the things that you have done through your teaching and your coaching that have had an impact with your colleagues? And, you know, Danielle was asking about Martin Luther King Jr. and how that has been impactful into your life and also your teaching and coaching. You know, just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned Martin Luther King, and I know we're on the eve of Martin Luther King Jr.'s celebration and such. And Martin Luther King has always been an inspirational hero to myself and to many, of course. And even through coaching and teaching, I just randomly quote him, quotes and excerpts from sermons and such to my students, even if it wasn't Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday or Black History Month and such. But one of the things that I've done is take the opportunity in coaching and teaching settings to bring him up and how, because of the work that he's done, we've progressed in many ways. Of course, we're not arrived. And I know, you know, we can continue to have debates on, you know, being in a post-racial society and such, but I know that he's done so many things to break barriers. And some of the things that I talk about, like, for example, not too long ago, I was mentioning to the girls that had it not been for Martin Luther King or some of the other civil rights leaders, I wouldn't be able to lead my basketball team, which is every one of them is a white girl, except for one, I believe, has Chinese background. But to be able to be a black man leading white athletes is huge in itself, you know, because if we think, you know, 60, 70 years ago, that probably would never have happened.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's been just an amazing opportunity to teach them and be a part of their experience. I know one day at practice, I canceled practice, and I took them up to one of our classrooms, and we watched the movie Glory Road, which is the story of Texas Western University, who was the first Division I school that had African Americans be a part of their, a great amount of African Americans to be a part of their roster. And in the championship game, they started five black athletes. And so just taking that opportunity to talk about faith and justice and how they kind of are connected in so many different ways. And just Martin Luther King being a believer, you know, and talking about his experience by using faith to empower all of us to pursue justice with guiding our with having our strength guided by the power of the Spirit and by the power that Christ bestows upon us to unite one another and to become one in community and such. And so those are some of the opportunities that I take advantage of because I have a platform. I mean, think about it in a coaching situation or teaching situation, but I'm going to specifically talk about coaching. Like many of us parents, we revolve our schedules around sports, right? I mean,
yeah.
We schedule vacations, we schedule our days, right? I mean, as a coach, I have a huge platform. There's many times where kids will quote things that I've said in practice or games far more than what I'll say even in the classroom, right? And so I know that as a coach, I have this huge platform to minister to them in ways where it can make a huge impact, you know, on them. And when it comes to faith and justice, I believe that we don't have to just talk about, you know, how to make a lay-in or how to make a shot, but also can talk about how can we be powerful in the athletic setting to change our world. Like one of the things that's inspiring me right now is in the past year or two in women's athletics. I mean, just a few days ago, the WNBA pay raise, right? Women's soccer.
Yep.
I mean, so many powerful things that are happening using sports to break barriers that maybe some other venues haven't been able to do. And I think that if I can empower or encourage or inspire my young athletes to know that they can make a difference through sport, then I think that that weighs more than any championship or win that I could ever accomplish.
Yeah, I love that you're using like right where God has put you, right where you believed you're called to be, to reach out and affect the people around you, and the ripple effect is going out, right? That's something I think about a lot. Like, where am I at? Who am I with? And how am I impacting the people I'm with? How are they impacting me? And what's the ripple effect going out?
Yeah, and I love what you and Maggie are doing, you know, and just listening some of the past podcasts of the different people that you have interviewed, wherever they are, therapists, or working in prisons, or, you know, in university settings and such. I think some people are like, well, I don't know what to do with regard to race and culture and social justice issues. I'm just an average person, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't have a specific title in when it comes to social justice or ethnic studies and such. I mean, I just jump right in and dive into it. You know, I go to clinic conferences, I go to parenting offerings that allow me to learn about what does it mean to teach my kids about race and culture. As a teacher and a coach, how can I teach information that will help people to be better teachers and coaches? I've led workshops on culturally responsive coaching. I've been a part of culturally responsive teaching, ethnic studies workshops, social justice and racial literacy workshops, and just being involved where I am. I mean, so many people ask me, like, so how can I grow in the work of justice? How can I grow when it comes to doing the work that many of them feel that Jesus has called us to, you know, to meet the needs of those that are powerless or marginalized? And I just encourage them, you got to be involved. You got to be in proximity of people that are in need, you know, whatever need they need, you know. I know I've been a part of, you know, Special Olympics. I don't have a lot of people in my life that have disabilities, but I dive in and I jump in and I'm like, how can I help? How can I serve? How can I learn more about what people with disabilities are wrestling with each and every day? Serving wherever you can, you know. And I'm not talking about just going on the random mission trip where you're like this one hit wonder, you go in, you do your service, right?
Yeah.
I'm talking about if you go to a community that you're not like or that's different from you, like spending time revisiting them, building community, making it a ministry, create a ministry, right? There's so many different opportunities. Of course, you don't want to force yourself on anybody, but if someone is reaching out to you or you think that you can build bridges together, I mean, take advantage of that, right? Mm-hmm. Proximity is so key, you know. One of the things that people always ask me, well, Dan, you have all these people of color in your life. You're a person of color. It's easy for you, you know. I'm a white male. How do I do that without making somebody like my token black friend, my token, you know, Chinese friend? Well, part of it is you have to be intentional, you know. Whether it's somebody at work that you know, you're like, hey, let's go to coffee. You want to go grab a bite at Red Robin? You know, you want to go, where do you go to church? Can I go visit church with you? You know, like, it's small things like that where you're starting to build a relationship and all of a sudden you have this close friendship, right? And not just one time want to go to their house or one time doing this or that. Like, that doesn't really build a relationship. That's just an experience, right? And I think relationship building is ongoing, continuous opportunities to be in proximity of the narratives and the stories of people that are just different from you, right? And not just visiting some, having somebody visit your house and eating dinner with them, but maybe having dinner several times or going to their house or going on a camping trip or being a part of some special event, you know, going to a quinceañera, but not only just going and experiencing the event, but also learning about, like, why is this an important thing for a 15-year-old in a Latino community, right? And so there's so many different ways where we can educate ourselves and such. I think so many people hold themselves back because they're like, I don't know much. I don't think I can help. I don't think I have enough to do. But I think just like in sports, we're going to make mistakes. We're going to make turnovers. We're going to throw the ball away. But that's how we learn and that's how we grow. And failure is such a huge opportunity to get to the point where you feel like you're making progress in your own journey.
Yeah, I really love all that you said. I mean, I felt that way myself, like, oh, I don't want to, you know, say anything or do anything. I don't think I know enough. And for sure, I definitely don't. And part of that, like you said, is being intentional and reading and listening and building relationships. I love how you had said proximity is key, and that we can start where we are by looking at what is already happening in our community and just asking ourselves to get involved, learning and listening. And that has been a process, you know, for Danielle and I too, as we've started with the interviewing people and realizing, like, we're for sure going to mess up, and we have and we do. And that's okay. And part of the learning process, like you said, is like allowing space for that, but continuing to grow. Like, you know, as an athlete, when you fall down or whatever, you get back up and you keep going and you learn from what has happened. And I think that's been, you know, the case for Danielle and I with this podcast, especially.
Yeah. It really struck me, just a couple things is the failure thing struck me recently. I blundered in a couple relationships with some friends of color, different background than I, and I went back and made it right and working on making it right in the relationship. And I was telling a friend about it, and she's a good friend. And I said, oh man, I made these rookie mistakes. Like, why did I do that? And she's like, you know what? You're going to go 20 years from now and you might make a rookie mistake. Yeah. It's just going to happen.
Yeah.
And I think I internally said to myself, why would I make this mistake? I've learned from that in the past. I'm married to Luis, speak Spanish in my home, know all these things. And yet I fell right into that and I missed relationship with someone. So now I realize this is like the next thing I realized, okay, so the mistake happened and I actually care about the relationship more than any other purpose. And after thinking that through, it hit me like the work of reconciliation. I think why so many people get out of it is because they want some quick and fast process. They want to say an apology. They want to get it out of the way. They want to move forward. And what really hit home for me is this is like a slow, slow process. It's almost like stitching together fabric by hand or weaving fabric by hand and making sure the colors fit and like getting an error and going back and like, and maybe you weave the mistake together and something more beautiful comes out of it. But reconciliation is not this fast process. It's not like a one-time apology. It's not like a one-time accepting an apology. Yeah. It's not a one-time asking for forgiveness or receiving forgiveness from someone else. It's this thing where we really have to dig in and say, hey, we're in it for the long haul. This is a lifestyle.
That's good.
I mean, isn't that what marriage is about too, right?
Yeah, so true. It's so true.
So, I mean, you know, and here's the other thing that people have to get past too is people of color can also do things that are hurtful as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to get into the debate because there's something that, you know, the debate, like, you know, you can't be racist if you're a person of color, but yet we can actually perpetuate racist ideology or things that can be harmful to people of color as well. You know, I mean, I know Danielle and I have talked about like books that we've read and everything like that. One of the books that I highly encourage people to read is by Ibram X. Kendi, which is how to be an anti-racist, because there's a difference between being non-racist and anti-racist. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things is like being non-racist, like, okay, you don't do things that are, you know, blatantly racist or anything like that. But being an anti-racist, like, you're intentional about changing the narrative, you know, in your life, in your home and such, you know. I mean, it's one thing to have your kid play on a ball team where, you know, kids of color is on there, but are you inviting those kids of color to your space? Are you inviting them to go hang out and spend the night with your kids? Are you inviting you to their house, right? Mm-hmm. Are you learning about people that are from a different culture, you know, and such, you know? And, you know, whenever I mention race, especially as a person of color, people get uncomfortable, you know? And some people might have just turned the podcast off right now because I just said the word race. And, you know, and people talk about privilege, and one of the parts of the definition of privilege is the ability to walk away, right? To not even have to talk about it. And so I think that we have to be intentional about not walking away and being okay with messing up and being okay with, you know, like, I'm going to say something that might offend somebody, but you know what? I want to grow. And, you know, and I'm okay that I said that because somebody that I love is going to challenge me and help me to not ever say it again, right? And a lot of people will say, you know, the enemy or the opposite of love is hate, but 1 John 4 will let you know that the opposite of love is fear, right? And think about all the things that we're afraid of. You know, your little kid that doesn't want to go on that tall slide, well, the more and more he exposes himself to that tall slide, the more he's going to be less fearful and take advantage of being a part of sliding down that slide. And I think that a lot of times we're fearful of others because we haven't taken that opportunity to slowly get to know one another, slowly break down those walls. And you know, as 1 John 4 says, perfect love dries out fear, you know, and when we speak love, of course, we're not going to like everybody, but I think that God challenges us to love one another, to get past differences, to get past, you know, harms and hurts, and to seek unity and seek reconciliation, as you guys have mentioned before, you know. And so there's so, I mean, just because I'm a person of color, that doesn't mean I'm a rise. Mm-hmm. As a person of color, I think I should educate myself even more and learn more about my history and my past. And I think that one of the things that we can move along together is to understand our shared history and to not ignore it. Just like you would want to understand your shared history, you know, in a marriage. You know, we have past baggage. We have things that we've had in our past, but how can we get past it? How can we reconcile and move forward and make times be more encouraging and comfortable and loving, where we can grow together and do big things for the Lord together? So that has been my journey. I know I feel myself, you know. Going back to my coaching experience, one of the things that I've tried to be more culturally responsive in the coaching setting is, I mean, let's be honest, one of the ways that I, as a male, can offend a female is talk about clothing sizes, right? And so what I did when we ordered new uniforms, the girls that I knew that were going to potentially be on varsity, I had our captain have them try on our samples. And they took down the sizes, and I sent them straight to the uniform designers, makers, or whatever, and had no idea who wore the size, right? And that's being culturally responsive because, you know, people that sometimes part of people's narrative is they don't want people to know what their size is. It makes them uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's not just even for my female athletes, my male athletes. Like now, when I used to coach football, I had different sizes. I would throw down boxes of different sizes. I said, these are small, these are the medium, these are the large. He goes, like, sometimes a boy doesn't want to be called, said that he's a small. Mm-hmm. Or a guy that doesn't want to say that he's an extra large, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to be proactive in knowing that we as coaches and teachers can do things that can be quite problematic or even traumatizing for kids. And as a person that maybe those kids respect, that can be very devastating. And it can really hurt somebody for a long time if we aren't very intentional about our interactions with youth.
Yeah, there's sort of this fine line between creating good tension, like you talked about, not being afraid to speak up, to be an anti-racist is more than just being being not racist, right? Being an anti-racist is an active action and a movement, and it reminded me of Dr. King's letter to from the Birmingham Jail. He talks about how he is not afraid of the word tension because it's tension that is necessary for growth. And then on the other hand, you know, I hear you talking about being sensitive and making sure that your players feel comfortable in regards to sizing and body image. And so like there's like this delicate, you know, balance of providing tension for growth and also comfort, you know, for so that, you know, like you said, there's no shame involved and or humiliation, you know, for a student. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and being able to have that and being honest with my athletes about, you know, why that happens, because some of them aren't used to that. You know, they're like, mm-hmm. Coach, why don't you just take the sizes? I'm like, well, you know what? Some people are uncomfortable sharing their sizes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, whenever we as coaches have an opportunity to teach kids about faith and justice, like, we got to jump on those opportunities. I mean, one of the examples I gave them is like, so we have practice after school, and I said, hey, go look out in the gym right now. And so what we would see is a bunch of boys just shooting our basketball, just throwing half-court shots. Mm. And we're literally like a minute or two before our practice starts, right? And then the next day we have practice after the boys' practice, and I say, go look at the gym right now. None of those boys were out there. And usually those boys are like football players or guys that are working out in the weight room. Mm. I said, do you guys see that as problematic? And they're like, no, like, what's wrong? Like, that, even though they may not say that they are sexist, and they may not be intentionally being sexist, but why do you think that they are shooting and doing all this stuff when you're about to practice and we need to get ready and put our equipment out to get when the boys are about to practice, they're not out there, right? Don't you find that quite problematic? So it's a great opportunity for me to talk about things where that are uncomfortable, you know, things that are tense, And a lot of times some of the kids don't want to talk about those things because they want things to be like, oh, we don't want to create drama and this and that. But at the same time, like, one of my mentors used to say, if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And maybe that's an MLK quote or whatever. But I just know that we have to stand for things that we find that are unjust, even the smallest little things and such, you know. You know, it's so funny because I live in Edmonds, Washington, where it's not very, you know, diverse.
Yeah.
You know, people go there for the bread and breakfasts. It's like a vacation spot for some people. But, you know, it's interesting because I'll be bumping my hip hop, and most of the time it's just Christian hip hop, and I'll get stares. And I'll just get stares and such, and, you know, and I'm like, hey, this is who I am. You know what I mean? And such, and I'll be blaring Toby Mac. And still, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And such. And so, and I talked about that with my kids too. And what does that look like, you know, and such. And there's, you know, recently I had a conversation with a colleague about racism in the North and the South. And they're like, oh, we're in the North. You know, it's not that racist and such. And you know, the South is way more racist. But I tell them, you know, we really have to do our research because there's a level of it in each setting in our country, you know. There's the assimilationist idea of, like, and which is very common in the, you know, in the South, where you can live with me, you can be in my neighborhood and everything like that. And if you do what I do, if you, like, you know, are doing things that make me feel comfortable and speaking like I speak and everything like that, then we're going to be able to live, you know, in proximity with one another. But like in the North, sometimes you have that segregationalist idea where I don't care if you're powerful. I don't care if you have a CEO job. I don't care if you're like the star or elite athlete or whatever you may be, a prestigious doctor, as long as you don't live by me or as long as you're not living in my neighborhood, right? You know, and I don't want to go into the topic of redlining, but we know that in Seattle, where there's been several instances of redlining and such. And so, And those are some of the conversations I even bring into the classroom, especially in my social justice club that I have on campus. We talked about those things where tension has occurred in those type of settings, and how can we, even as youth, how can you be intentional about changing those narratives?
Yeah, I think just talking with someone earlier today and just thinking that it's far hard, it's easy to say, well, you know, for instance, if I was just to say, well, I'm mostly, or I'm half white, or I appear as white, I can't do anything about that. Or I could say, well, that happened. It's too bad. I'm sorry it happened, you know, but I can't change that. And one thing that someone, we were talking about a different subject, but same concept, like when you actually are invited to name the particularity of a way you've engaged racism, or you've sat in silence as someone made a crude joke about someone of another race. I mean, I remember sitting at in a crowd of group of Christians, and someone started talking about Asian Americans. It was general like that. And they always do this or that. And I remember feeling shocked. I was in such a big crowd. And Luis and I kind of looked at each other and felt startled and walked out, and we didn't say anything. And I remember thinking back, like, oh yeah, it felt so bad to even hear that. But if I don't actually name that I stayed silent right there and I left and I didn't stay, if I don't say that I did that, even if it's just between Luis and I, and now it's between all of us, then the next time something like that happens, I'm likely to repeat the same thing. With whatever race or nationality or whatever it is, ethnic culture it is, I might stay silent, but I don't want to do that. So I have to actually sit in the pain of it and realize I'm not all good, I'm not all bad, and I have these faults, and I have to work with them. And so, just like you said, I love that you name particular ways that you've experienced racism and other ways that you're working towards it, because I think we all have to name the ways that, you know, we've participated, you know, silently. And I don't think those are for public commentary. I think they're with your close friends or your family who can kind of hold you accountable and work through that. I don't think, you know, we go up to strangers and say, I did this, I did that. But I think there's something particular about naming, like, I stayed silent here, I'm not going to do that again, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just kind of a thought I had.
Yeah, Martin Luther King, I remember he said, and I may trash it, but there comes a time when violence is betrayal,
yeah.
You know, and that our life begins to end the day when we become silent about things that matter.
Mm.
And he used to say, you know, the person that sits in silence, the person that's complicent about wrongdoings or injustice, is just as harmful as somebody that's actually doing the harm, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that to, you know, to judge you or to make you feel bad or anything, because I've been there as well. I mean, yeah. I can think of many times growing up, or even as of late, where I said something that was, you know, sexist or racist or something like that, you know, because those are the systems I grew up with. And those are things I've seen through media or TV or heard in song and such. And I'm perpetuating the stereotypes or whatever it may be, you know. And now that I've educated myself more, if that does occur, I'll challenge myself and I'll ask the person for forgiveness. That should have never even happened. That should have never came out of my lips. Mm-hmm. And such, but also humble about it. Like, knowing I can do that. I can be wrong too, you know, and such. Mm-hmm. And I think that God calls us to do that. God calls us to humble ourselves and to ask for forgiveness in those specific situations and such, you know. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what you're saying is so huge when it comes to speaking up. And in those, I mean, I remember I was sitting with a family member and we were watching the NBA, and he goes, "Man, I don't like watching these guys. They play a lot of jungle ball." I was like, "Jungle ball?" You know, and the whole court was black athletes.
Oh,
wow. Right? Like, very interesting comment. So we had this conversation and everything like that and such. And, you know, and he didn't, what was cool is he didn't take offense to it. He goes, "I can see how that could be problematic and everything." And then we were able to grow from that, you know.
I love it. And
it's actually easier if you do have a relationship with that person, mm-hmm. you know, because if they know that you're coming at them in a loving and humble way, instead of antagonistic and yelling at them and saying, "Hey, how could you say this?" I think that they'll be way more receptive, right? I mean, you're in therapy, and I'm sure you've had discussions on the amygdala, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how our amygdala gets hijacked, you know, in intense situations and adverse circumstances. And I think that if we hijack somebody's amygdala when we're trying to challenge them about something that is inappropriate or problematic, then they're not going to be as receptive. Even if we are in the right, they're just not going to be as receptive as we would want them to be.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're doing, even at our school, in our school community, is our staff members are going through this article called Speak Up at School, which is basically, if we hear microaggressions or we hear inappropriate talk when it comes to, you know, race or culture type of conversations that goes on, like challenging ourselves to say something. And, you know, we may not do it to a perfect science, but we can't sit back and let it happen, you
for
know?
Sure.
And even if it's to the point of, "Hey, I hear what you're saying. Can I talk to you after class?"
Yeah.
That right there immediately communicates to the rest of the class, this is probably not the best thing to communicate right now, right? And even for myself, like, I've had to challenge myself in certain situations where, do I confront this? Do I not? Like, how do I handle this? You know, one of the situations that I can think of is I do a name quiz in my health class where, you know, how you've gone through a whole semester class and you don't know everybody's name, right? And so I quiz my kids on the names, and that's their first test, and it's a point per student. And one of the kids, as we're reviewing, says, "Man, that's a weird name." Like, puppy break. You know, I didn't say that out loud, but I'm like, yeah. Okay, great teaching moment, right? And so we talked about, you know, the differences of names. And once we get to know the pronunciation, it becomes so easy. And in their culture, that might be the most common name. In our culture, it might be Taylor or Smith or whatever it may be, right? And so just taking advantage of this, speak up when we can. And we're going to make mistakes, you know? Mm-hmm. We're gonna go through situations where we're going to hear stuff and we're like, "Dang it, I should have said something,"
yeah.
You know? Or we hear something and then later after the fact, we're like, "That actually wasn't appropriate," you know? And so it's a journey.
It's totally a journey. And actually hearing you talk about your experiences with your students, I still remember in I think it was 11th grade, my teacher, Mr. Eller, he was teaching social studies, and he had said, "Silence is agreement." And I have never forgotten it.
Yeah.
And just like you're talking about these speak up at school and you know, bringing up the conversation around microaggressions and that sort of thing. Like, it is so important that we understand that doing nothing is actually continuing the problem. And so I love this conversation around silence. You know, that's why we have this podcast. That's, you know, why we had you on today. And it's been so great to hear about your experiences as a coach and a teacher and the ways that you're incorporating your own continued learning. And at the end of all of our podcasts, we always ask our guest what you are reading right now, what you are listening to, and what is inspiring you.
I am right now currently, well, one of my roles at the school that I have is working with diversity and equity on our campus. We have a group of staff members that have created a professional development opportunity called CARE, which is Community Action, Reconciliation, and Equity. And so I'm continually looking for resources and articles and research and books to help me to grow each and every day and such. And it's been great. So people that inspire me are the people that are on my CARE team that are willing to do the work.
That's
my
awesome.
Staff members who are very receptive of us coming in to do professional development. We're at the foundational level, and we're, you know, trying to do our best, especially in the faith community. I mean, you don't hear a lot of conversations about race and culture in faith communities.
It's true.
It's like something that's just like, we don't talk about that, you know, like,
yeah,
kind of like politics,
yep,
sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so, those are the folks that are inspiring me right now, that are receptive of me talking about race and culture and equity and things that are important, not only to our nation and our world, but more specifically in my immediate world, our youth, right? Just a few years ago, our nation in the public school setting went over 50% of kids of color in schools.
Wow.
You know, and
I knew that. I knew that was going to happen.
Yeah. And then, but yet our staff are not, you know, when you talk about teachers and such. And so I think staff members right now that are in the work or going to conferences and going to professional development, those are the most inspiring people for me right now.
That's awesome.
As far as books, I used to be one that just like sores through a book. I take a book and I'm not going to look at anything else until I finish it. But now what I've tell myself to do is go through a book and forget some of the great stuff that I just read. So what I do now is I go through many books and pick out certain chapters, one and a marinate in that chapter, right? And so I want to really dive into the book, but also not just skip over the topic that the author made. So like for me, as a parent, a husband, a coach, a teacher, someone that's wanting to do work in faith and justice, I always try to read a book in each and every one of those categories at one time and such. But right now, the one, I would just say the most immediate one that I was reading yesterday is a book by Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove called Reconstructing the Gospel, Finding Freedom from Slaveholder Religion. And he's, I believe, a white minister that's basically taking us through some of the history of the church and how in many ways we have not used the gospel in the way that Christ has challenged us to, and kind of similar tones of The Color of Compromise, which I believe was a book that you guys mentioned in the previous podcast.
Yeah, I love that book. Yeah.
But this one in particular from a white American male, and so I really love it, and it's one of those ones I'm tempted to go to the next chapter, you know, like when you binge watch your TV shows.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
exactly.
I'm just so, but yeah, I'm really into this book, like, you know, highlighting almost every other word and such. So, and then was there a third question?
Yeah, what are you listening to? It could be music.
Well, I'm listening to the Arise podcast.
Well, thank you.
I think I've only missed one episode so far, but I'll catch up. And I love reading the blogs and everything too. But I, as of the past 2 years, I've been a huge fan of podcasts. And those five areas as well, like parenting, coaching, teaching, so forth. Jamar Tisby has a great one.
Mm-hmm.
That, how long am I spacing out? I might have to like pull up my podcast on my phone and such. You know, I don't know if you guys have heard of Think Biblically, which is one by Josh McDowell. That's one that I love. Pass the Mic, I think, is Jamar Tisby's. One of the things, as being a male, I think that I've been challenged lately, especially leading female athletes, to learn about the narrative of women. And I listen to podcasts that are led by women. Some people might think that's odd and different, but I don't, you know. And but I think that hearing the narrative of women has really opened my perspective on so many different things. It's allowed me to even get into the thought process of my own life and such, you know. And so it's been really enriching in so many different ways. Speaking of Racism is a podcast. Seeing on Radio, they have a series that's called Seeing White, I think it's called, and such. But yeah, I can go on about podcasts. So I'm gonna
why don't you send us a list, Dan? Text me a list or email me a list of what you're listening to, and I'll put links up for it. I think people will be interested in that.
For sure.
Well, thank you for so much for coming out with us, and I'm hoping you'll join us again in the future.
Oh, yeah. This is Steve Blessing and Danielle to reconnect. I mean, you know, people don't always say that there's peers that inspire them, but you inspire me. Maggie, I've gotten to know you through the podcast, yeah. You know, which is awesome. You know, hopefully I'll be able to meet you in person, but I know that it's just been a very big blessing to be a part of the podcast. And I know that the listeners out there, I highly encourage you guys to keep following, find other podcasts that you know that will enrich you and help you to grow in this work.
Yeah.
Because I believe that God's called us to meet the needs of those that are oppressed, marginalized, or just hurting, you know, in general. So love you all.
Yeah, I love you, brother.
Thank you so much.
Yep, we'll be in touch. Peace.
Peace.
Bye.